So, this is the historical background, the United Kingdom since 1960, and if this is forming the background to what we're going to look at concerning then multiculturalism and diversity. So I'm going to try to give you the political history, the basic facts, in only 2 hours, which is quite an achievement, really. So let's start off. The 1960s. What was life like in the 1960s? Did it resemble? This is a very, very long time ago for you. I remember the 1960s, although I was born in 1960. So when I was born, this was what a television set looked like. And this does have a certain importance. I mean, the television did allow people to see things happening at the other side of the world, which normally they would only see a little bit of at the cinema. You know, went to see the news at the cinema. And, of course, the radio was tremendously important. But it does look a long time ago, doesn't it, this particular kind of machine. So what was happening with televisions? Television is important. In 1946, there were only 15,000 license holders in Britain, only 15,000, so it's really for a very, very small group. But by 1956, 5 million. Yeah, 5 million by 1956. So it was beginning to get up. When I was in primary school, half the children had a television and half the children did not. In my family, we were in between. We rented a television every winter. Only for the winter. Okay, so this was the time when you could rent television. Of course, televisions were very expensive as well, much more expensive than they are today. Television itself was changing in the 1950s. At the beginning of the 1950s, the BBC had a monopoly. Only state television was allowed, and independent television, or private television, was founded in 1954. British television was a pioneer in many ways. They invented the TV quiz show. In 1961, with shows like Double Your Money and Beat Your Clock, Beat the Clock. 1964, then, what are the other kinds of technology which are transforming people's lives? Well, 52%, in 1964, 52% of families have washing machines. About half of them have washing machines. Okay, just to give you an idea. But this is particularly then the period of the post-war boom. Now, the post-war economic boom was very surprising to people. People assumed that before the Second World War, there'd been this terrible crisis in the 1930s. Terrible, terrible crisis. Mass poverty, mass unemployment all over the world. And then there was the Second World War, which obviously was not a lot of fun, but everybody had a job. And people tended to assume that after the Second World War, well, you would again get the terrible crisis. And people were rather surprised to find that there was the biggest boom in the history of the economic system. In French, you use the expression les trente glorieuses, and it's a phrase we hear so often that it gets a bit worn out, the phrase, really. But it seems to me that it's quite an appropriate phrase. I mean, certainly the biggest improvements in ordinary people's living standards in history happened in the 1950s and the 1960s. That was a bigger one. This was the time of free hospitals. I'm talking about Britain, yeah? Free doctors. Whereas in the 20s, and my grandmother remembers in the 20s, you went to find, of course you didn't phone the doctor, you didn't have a phone, you went to find the doctor if your children were ill, but if the adults were ill, then you didn't have the money to go for a doctor. So all of that transformed in massive social reforms in particular areas. And in particular in Britain, we were rather lucky because they established the National Health Service on the basis that health care should be free at the point of use. That is to say, it's not reimbursed, it's not refunded, you just don't have to pay, which is something obviously we're very proud of. And it's also something that governments have not been able to change, because if there had never been free medical care, they could probably have kept it there. But once people have it, it would become very, very difficult to take away. So even today, when you go to see a doctor, you don't need a checkbook. And indeed, when I came to France, I felt very bizarre taking a checkbook to a doctor. It was like dirty. It was like writing a check to a policeman. You know, it's a very cultural difference here. So a tremendous moment of rising living standards. This doesn't mean that poverty disappeared, but it meant that poverty, which had been 30%, was 5%. You know, there were still pockets of poverty going on. Also, so tremendous improvements in the 50s and the 60s in people's housings. Now, these high towers, we're often very critical of them today. We say, well, you know, it's just piled up and sometimes they're not so well repaired. Nevertheless, at the time, this was a very big improvement of what people had before. For the first time, the majority of the population have toilets inside the house. And these kind of improvements, which are important. Between 1948 and 1970, for 22 years, normally unemployment was around 2%. Now, 2% is just people who have stopped one job and haven't found another one yet. This is fundamentally zero. This is fundamentally zero. And this transformed people's lives because in 1955, in 1965, if the foreman was treating you not very well, you just left. In fact, my father did this once on Thursday. He was very angry with the foreman. He left and he found another job on Monday. Yeah, don't do this today. The situation has changed. Yeah. Of course, this meant then a tremendous confidence for ordinary workers. Welcome, you're late. Can you arrive on time, please?
I'm sorry.
I just explained all the important stuff at the beginning. You'll have to ask people later. Okay, this meant tremendous confidence for workers, because, of course, when unemployment is very low, then workers have a lot of influence. Trade unions are very powerful. In certain places, in some of the car factories, they used to take a piece of chalk and they drew a line over there. And it says, if the foreman crosses the line, we're on strike. Yeah. Because the bosses could easily be persuaded to give the workers what they wanted, because otherwise the workers would go and work in the factory next door. Yeah. So that was the kind of situation. Society still rather traditional at the time. We're talking about the 1960s. Society still rather traditional. Some changes happening. This is the 1957 report for the Home Office. The Committee on Homosexual Offences and Prostitution, of course, homosexuality was illegal at the time, and this report tells us a lot, very important moments. This report tells us a lot. First of all, notice that for the establishment, homosexuality and prostitution, it was all more approximately the same thing, you know, it was all horrible, dirty things, you know. And so they have the same Committee on Homosexual Offences and Prostitution. And in fact, this committee recommended that homosexuality be legalised, but it took 10 years for it to happen. The 1950s was the worst time in history in Britain to be homosexual. It was dangerous. You couldn't write down any of your friends' addresses, because the police, if they arrested you, they would then go at 6 o'clock in the morning and arrest all your friends, because you have their phone numbers, and so they might be homosexuals. Very, very dangerous place. Very high rate of suicide. This was the hardest time. So still a traditional society, but some signs that change was happening. If we look at the politics, at the beginning of the 1950s, Harold Macmillan was the Conservative Prime Minister, sometimes known as Super Mac. There he is on the front cover of Time magazine, then an American magazine, who always have having your picture on the front cover. The front cover of Time is apparently quite an ambition in political circles. I've never had my picture on the front cover of Time for the moment, but I'm working on it. And one of the interesting things about Harold Macmillan is that in one of the elections that he stood in 1958, one of the slogans he was well known for was, "Let us be frank about it, most of our people have never had it so good." Nous n'avons jamais aussi bien vécu. Okay. Now, I don't know if you can imagine a politician today going into an election on the slogan "We have never lived so well." Could be difficult. Could be difficult. So that's the kind of atmosphere that we had at the time. The 1960s, then, beginning with Harold Macmillan, and then moving on to the Labour Party, which I will speak about in a moment, is the period of decolonisation. Britain is obliged to realise, the British establishment is obliged to realise, that they cannot maintain this enormous empire, the biggest empire in the history of the world. And the moment of truth is probably 1956 in Suez, where they organise a secret invasion of Egypt with France and Israel. They were not expecting the secret document to to be released, but we have the secret document. And the idea was, what they said to Israel, said, you invade Egypt, and then we will arrive to separate the two sides. Okay, so it was, even by the standards of international diplomacy, it was particularly disgusting. But what actually happened is that they did this, and then the American president sent his deputy on a fast plane to London and said, stop now or we won't give you any money anymore. And they stopped the next day. And so by real force, Britain was obliged to understand that they no longer had the capacity for an independent imperial intervention. And when America said no, they were very, very polite. The letter from the president is wonderful. It says, you do understand that it will be difficult for us to continue with our support for your currency. It means, stop now or we won't give you any money. So a very, very vicious shock for the elite. But that led to a real understanding that the time of colonies was closing. And in February 1960, Harold Macmillan makes a very famous speech, the Wind of Change speech. And this we will be looking at later. And this is when he recognises publicly that independence for African countries is the future. So he's more or less obliged, but then they take it in they're relatively pragmatic about it, and many analysts believe that the British elite were rather intelligent in the way that they decolonised. And certainly Britain managed to leave all its colonies, except for two or three little ones, without a major war. So, of course, France did not manage this. France, they had the Algerian War, and Britain managed to avoid a major war. Now, this doesn't mean that there was no violence at all. The big exception was Kenya. In Kenya, in 1959, there was a horrible series of tortures, and in particular one episode in March 1959, when 85 prisoners were attacked by the guards of the colonial force and beaten all day until 11 of them were dead and 60 were seriously injured. This was done in secret, but the story got back to London, was published in the newspapers, and was a major scandal. And one of the results was that 1 year later, Jomo Kenyatta, who was a nationalist leader in prison, was released. And 4 years after that massacre, Kenya was granted independence. So that was the most violent, probably, of the decolonisations. And that particular episode in 1959, of torture in Kenya came back into the news recently, because this in London 2011, there was a court hearing where the UK government recognised that Kenyans were tortured and paid compensation of £20 million to the survivors, of course, and to some of the families, and so that was officially. Now there were thousands killed in the repression of the revolt against British rule in Kenya, and that's symbolic. Now I'm not going to give you a list of the colonies which got independence in the 1960s, because the list is like 36 countries or something like that. It's absolutely enormous. But let's say that it became accepted by the British elite, and indeed, rather strangely, the Queen was very often present at the independence celebrations in the different countries, which is slightly unusual in a way, but it's a good party, I suppose. So, what else was going on at the beginning of the 1960s? Well, one of the big movements at the time was the campaign for nuclear disarmament. And here you have a picture, an example of a demonstration of the campaign for nuclear disarmament in 1961. You see there the symbol of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, which has since been used by many people and considered to mean many things. The origin of it is simply semaphore for ND, nuclear disarmament. I think it's ND, I don't know. And that's the meaning of that symbol is nuclear disarmament, ND. This was quite a big rebellion, quite a big set of demonstrations. Quite unusual to see masses of people on the streets protesting about foreign policy, relatively unusual before the 1960s. Of course, with the Vietnam War, this would become very common across the world. And a couple of specific things about the campaign for nuclear disarmament. First of all, it was characterized by a number of women leaders, whereas this had previously been extremely rare to have women leaders. Even then, I'm not saying the majority were women, but there was that. And they had some success because in 1960, at the conference, the Labour Party, then the biggest left-wing party, of course, voted for unilateral nuclear disarmament. And there was an enormous debate within the Labour Party. And 1 year later, the conference voted against unilateral disarmament. This is when the Labour Party are in opposition, because Harold Macmillan, the Conservative, will be the Prime Minister from 1958 till 1964. So while the Labour Party were in opposition, there was this big debate on nuclear disarmaments. So if we get to 1964, we find the election of the Labour Party under Harold Wilson. And here you have a picture of Harold Wilson. And there are a couple of fascinating things about the picture. The first thing is the pipe. And apparently the pipe is meant to make you feel that, oh, he's a very generous, kindly father sort of figure. And I've been told, I don't know if this is true, that in private he preferred cigars. But the image of a man smoking a cigar and a man smoking a pipe in Britain of the 1960s were very different. Yeah. And the other thing which is very notable thing is here is you look at his coats, his mac. It's very much a working class coat, a cheap working class coat. This is not an accident. Part of the being a man of the people, this was an important part of his image. So what did he do in government? Well, the first thing to note is that he did not really take much further the reforms of 1945. The Labour Party in 1945 had made enormous reforms: nationalisation of gas, railways, electricity, etc., free hospitals, free hospitals is the biggest one, free doctors, the welfare states, which is, again, we need to look at that expression in some detail, because we just say the welfare state very quickly, but it does 100 different things. And 1964, by the time the Labour Party got in 1964, they were not so interested, the leadership, in radical reform. Nevertheless, he did bring in a certain number of reforms. He was very much influenced by the idea that science and technology were advancing very quickly, and that this was a way to make the country advance, to make society advance. And also remember, of course, that you must remember that during the Trente Glorieuses, people did not say, oh, we've had 23 years, there are only 7 years left of the boom. Of course, they didn't know it was going to finish. In fact, the general opinion was that it was never going to finish, that there would never be mass unemployment again. This was the general opinion. And so there was a tendency among many thinkers to think that the conflict between workers and bosses was not really so necessary anymore, because the economy was going to continue getting better. And this is certainly what Wilson would say. I mean, in his most famous speech, he said, "In all our plans for the future, we are redefining and we are restating our socialism in terms of the scientific revolution. The Britain that is going to be forged in the white heat of this revolution will be no place for restrictive practices or for outdated methods in either side of industry." So science, technology, and so on, this was going to bring Britain forward rather than radical social reform. And one of the results of this was that he tried to establish a new way of dealing between bosses and trade unions. The trade unions very powerful at this time, of course. When there's low unemployment, trade unions are very powerful. And the result was this white paper. That is to say, it's a policy. It's not a law, but it's a policy entitled "In Place of Strife, yeah, pour remplacer le conflit between trade unions and between workers and bosses, between capitalists and trade unions." So that's the idea. Now, of course, this is a very, very political document, a very specific idea that this is saying is putting forward the idea that it is not necessary to have conflict between workers and employers. That's the idea here. Now, in general, remember that in Britain you have the Labour Party and the Conservative Party as the two very much dominant parties. And within each party, you have different opinions. So inside the Labour Party, you have two opinions. You have this opinion, the right of the Labour Party. Conflict is not necessary between workers and bosses. How can we reduce conflict? And you have the left wing of the Labour Party. There will always be conflict between workers and bosses. We want the workers to win. And you have the same in the Conservative Party. On the left of the Conservative Party, you have conflict is not necessary between workers and bosses. And on the right of the Conservative Party, you can't get past that, you have there will always be conflict between workers and bosses. We want the bosses to win. Okay, so I simplify, of course, a little bit, but that's about more or less the mainstream within the... Of course, you have people out there and out there, but in the mainstream, those are the main opinions. And so this was put forward then as an idea. What did they want to do? Well, they said, if you want to go on strike, you must give 2 weeks' notice. You must say, we are going on strike on the 15th of November, or on the 17th, yeah, 2 weeks' notice. This was a proposal that you agree, that the unions agree to give 2 weeks' notice. Now, I don't know if you have ever organised a strike, but if you want to win, the best time to go on strike is now, immediately, before the boss can prepare. Oh, I'm going to deal with your customers first, and you can do this and organise everything so it doesn't work, you know. And so this was obviously going to weaken trade unions. However, it did not actually happen because the trade unions refused to cooperate. And in place of strife was an idea that collapsed completely. The trade unions were too strong to have this kind of restriction imposed upon them. What else did Harold Wilson do? Well, here you have a little list of some of the important changes that happened during the Wilson government, 1964 to 70. And this very colourful guy, I think I said this at the Brighton conference, I assure you I do, that was a very good imitation of Harold Wilson, never mind. Here are a number of the big changes that he made. 1967, the legalisation of abortion. 1968, the decriminalisation of homosexuality between men over 21. 1968, the founding of the Open University, and 1970, the Equal Pay Act. And I will just comment each of these in turn. First of all, the legalisation of abortion, obviously a very important reform because many women were dying from illegal abortions. And in fact, the main reason that the government decided to legalise abortion was the number of thousands and thousands of women ending up in hospital because of illegal attempts at abortion outside hospitals, just in people's homes. A very good film about this, Vera Drake, if you have a chance to see it. Decriminalisation of homosexuality. Again, the main reason was not public opinion. The main reason was that the police, after the Second World War, became more and more active. And every year there were now 3,000, 4,000 arrests and people taken to the tribunals for being homosexual. So, also, the government was rather worried about blackmail, that people in high places could be blackmailed. So that was one of the reasons. But both of these two laws have two very important characteristics. The first is that they are part of a more general trend that says that questions of morality are the questions for the individual and not for the government. So the idea was, before the old idea was, part of the job of the government is to control the morality of the country. And so because most people at this time felt that homosexuality was immoral, it was normal that it should be illegal. Whereas the new way of looking at it was morality is an individual question and legality is another thing. So seeing that homosexuality is not dangerous for anybody else, then you know, it's an individual question. And so these two both are part of an idea that morality is not the government's job, which is an idea which rises very slowly. You'll be thinking about this, I would think. Rises very slowly. And the second thing is that both of these reforms were not mentioned in the 1964 and the 1966 election campaigns. That is that although the Labour Party wanted to do them, they thought, if we put it in our election manifesto, we might lose too many votes. They were not convinced it was so popular. Yeah. It's very difficult to know how popular it was, in fact. There are many signs that prejudices against homosexuals were not as general in the population as people thought. But it was difficult because nobody was talking about it. So those two changes, important changes there, also symbolic of also people being more accepting about divorce. I've seen in my lifetime the change in vocabulary. When I was little, somebody who lived in a home with their mother and not with their father, we said they come from a broken home. That was the normal expression, a broken home. And of course today we talk about single parent families. It's much more positive than a broken home, is that? Oh, my home is broken. Yeah, okay, so very, very interesting changes. Very slow. The other two changes, they're very important. 1968, the founding of the Open University. Now, the Open University is a wonderful place, and it's a university where you can learn at a distance. And in particular, the idea was for women who didn't go out to work that they could do higher education. So it was a chance for mature students, older students, to get a degree, get a university degree. And this was at the same time as the founding of many new universities. There were many new universities established in the 1960s, partly because of the changes in industry, that the industry needed more engineers. We need more engineers. We need more experts. We need not computer scientists. It's too early. So much more university than the Open University. And finally, 1970, the Equal Pay Act. So before 1970, in 1969, you open the newspaper, it says, we want a secretary, £30 a week for a man, or £25 a week for a woman. Yeah, it was not illegal, it was normal. And 1970 is the Equal Pay Act, which says, no, you must give the same wages for the same job. Now, of course, it takes quite a while for it to be put into practice, because there are lots of secret ways to discriminate. But nevertheless, it was the first step, the Equal Pay Act. And interestingly here you have then a political cartoon. You can see here is Labour with the Equal Pay Act and the lady who is profiting from it. And these are the Conservatives who, according to the cartoonist, would like to steal the bag. Yeah, so beware of bag snatchers. Yes, political cartoons of the time. So here are the changes. Other changes along the same lines. If you've got the Open University and the new universities, this was also a new idea. Many, many people can go to university. It's not necessary to restrict it to a small elite. So this is a more democratic principle. It's also a more meritocratic principle. In the past, many people believed that, oh, well, it's natural for only 10% of people to go to university because the rest of the population is not intelligent enough. And there were very many people who thought you were born intelligent or born not intelligent. And this is an idea which slowly reduces, and the idea that, that everybody should be able to have some studying is on the rise. Okay, so that's a kind of democratic idea, and at the same time they changed the school system. The school system established in 1945 meant that at the age of 11 you took an examination, and a quarter of the population went to intellectual schools called grammar schools, where they would learn Latin, and they might go to university. And three-quarters of the population went to secondary modern schools, where the boys would learn woodwork and the girls would learn domestic science. Now, of course, they didn't only learn that, they also did mathematics and English and so on. But nevertheless, the message was very clear. A division at 11 years old, a complete division, and almost impossible to change afterwards. And this principle was abolished in the 1960s. Now, this is Britain, so it was abolished region by region. And it took 15 years. It took 15 years. One region, then another region. Because education has always been regional in Britain. So that's the most important changes then of the times of Harold Wilson, 1964 to 1970. Also a time, of course, the 1960s, of course, rock and roll, skiffle and such like things, wanted to give you one example for the cultural change, and that was the Liverpool poets, Adrian Henry, Roger McGoffin, not Brain Pattern, of course, but Brian Pattern. He wasn't called Brain, he was called Brian. And these were interesting people because they wrote poems about ordinary people's lives. And this was a new idea at the time, and they were very popular. They used to go and read their poems in pubs. So it was a kind of new kind of movement. Poetry had been something, probably translated from the Latin, you know, it was something for the elite. And this was part of a movement to popularise poetry. And they're still pretty popular poets today. Roger McGough is still writing. So I just wanted to use that example as a symbol then of cultural changes, where obviously rock and roll is tremendously important. But also in other areas too. This is also the time when the government began to worry about the ordinary people. They said, we want everybody to be able to go to the museums. Why don't we make the museums free? And as you probably know, museums are still free in Britain today, which is nice. Which is nice, I think. Well, I'm a historian. I go to museums. That's what I do with my life, so that's normal. Okay, in foreign policy, Harold Wilson was known for his attitude for the Vietnam War. Of course, there were a lot of demonstrations in America, but also in Britain against the Vietnam War. And Harold Wilson stood somewhere in the middle. He announced that he wanted the United States to win, but he refused to send British soldiers to Vietnam. Now, of course, now we know what the situation was. Of course, today we think, oh, good idea, don't send British soldiers to Vietnam. Because at the time, nobody imagined that America could lose. I mean, it was such a ridiculous thing. You've got the United States, the most powerful economy in the world, and Vietnam? I mean, how could they possibly win? But they did win. And that, of course, transformed the political situation in the 1960s, because many groups of people around the world, whether it be black people in the United States or Catholics in Northern Ireland, they say, if Vietnam can win against America, maybe we could win something as well. You know, it's very difficult to exaggerate the effect of 1968, the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, where the Americans were just destroyed by these amazing Vietnamese soldiers, of whom, some of whom were 14-year-old girls. You know, there's just incredible stories out there. So that's the end of what I had to say about Harold Wilson. We're moving into the 1970s, because in 1970 we get a new prime minister, Conservative prime minister again. This is, of course, a bit of a tendency in Britain to go Labour, Conservative. And this is Edward Heath, Prime Minister 1970 to 1974. A particular sort of Prime Minister. What was particular about him was that he did not come from an aristocratic background. He didn't come from a very rich background. And this was unusual at the time for Conservative leaders. He did have a... He really did look like that. Caricaturists used to go... That was Edward Heath. And I've just chosen four examples of his political life as Prime Minister, because obviously I can't give you 35 examples, because that would be too many. In fact, there are two main themes here. These are three themes which will come back for every government. The first is the question of the relationship with trade unions. That is to say that under every government, there are always sometimes conflicts between employers and employees. The whole question of what the government should do about this, should they not intervene? Should they support the trade unions? Should they support the employers? This is a very controversial issue. And naturally, of course, the Conservative Party very solidly on the side of the employers. So what they attempted to do was the Industrial Relations Act. So let me have a go at the Industrial Relations Act. Yes, so this was really rather similar to In Place of Strife, but going even further, they wanted to allow the minister to impose strike ballots, that is to say, paper voting for a strike. The traditional way of voting for a strike was, who wants to go on strike? I do, you just raise your hand. Let's decide like that. And they wanted to make this illegal. They also wanted to impose cooling off periods, what they called cooling off periods. That is to say, again, you cannot go on strike tomorrow, you must go on strike in 2 weeks' time. So, of course, the aim was to make unions less powerful. However, a democratic government can't do anything that they wanted, and so they didn't make it legally obligatory. They made it so that trade unions There are many trade unions. Trade unions had certain advantages if they agreed to work within the system. It was a failure in that all the trade unions disagreed, all the trade unions refused again. So we again have this same moment. Now, I will come back to the trade unions in a moment, but first of all, I need to have a little look at 1972, Bloody Sunday. Bloody Sunday is an episode in the history of Northern Ireland. You can see the film on it. The film is not bad, but it has a little problem in that it only tells you what happened on one day. And if you just look at one day, you just can't understand what it's about, because you never can. You know, it's like looking at one minute. But fundamentally, since the division of Ireland into two in the early 1920s, there had been widespread discrimination against Catholics. It was very, very difficult to get a good job if you were Catholic. Also the Royal Ulster Police, the police force, was, I think it was 96% Protestant. The Catholics were 35% of the population, and the police was like 96% Protestant. It was basically there was no confidence between the Catholic population and the police. Certainly in the 1960s in Belfast, if you had a problem and you were a Catholic, you would not phone the police. You would have to be stupid to phone the police. They would come and take your children instead. It was just absolutely, there was no confidence at all involved. In any case, there were a series of demonstrations and movements for equal rights for Catholics. And this is the demonstration on Sunday, in January the 30th, Sunday 1972, January the 30th, the Civil Rights Association. And you can see the sort of demonstration it is. Interesting sort of demonstration. You can see just by looking at that it's a popular demonstration. You see there are not many banners, not a lot of political parties and so on, in fact, you know, just a lot of people. One very popular organisation, the Civil Rights Association, behind Bernard Devlin and so on. And indeed, in this time, there's a big debate in Northern Ireland among the Catholics. Some people saying, yeah, we need demonstrations, petitions, talk to your Member of Parliament, we can make progress against anti-Catholic discrimination this side, in this way. And a small group who said no. As long as the British occupied Northern Ireland, there will be no real progress. We need a military struggle against Britain. Of course, this is the IRA, who were very, very small in 1971. And then you have this demonstration will change the situation completely. And in fact, what will happen is at the end of the demonstration, the British Army will shoot, I think it's 12 men, and here you have an example of the situation. This man is a priest, and what he's holding is a white handkerchief, you know, to try to stop the soldiers from shooting, a sort of surrender thing. And whereas they're carrying this man, I think he's already dead, in fact. And they're carrying this man. In any case, what happened was that the army killed, I think it's 12 men. Now, this is obviously very shocking, but not that rare across the world. What was rather particular about this situation is that the men were killed in a square in front of their houses, which were these big tower blocks, and thousands of people saw it happen. Thousands of people saw it. Everybody looked. And then the next day in the newspapers, it said the soldiers were attacked and were obliged to defend themselves. And the Parliament in London voted to support the soldiers, that they were obliged to shoot because they had to defend themselves. Whereas, in fact, the men were shot in the back, and they were not armed. And in fact, this statement that the men were shot in the back and they were not armed is not my opinion. Today, it is the official opinion of the British government. Today, 20 years later. In fact, in 2012, the government officially apologised. And said that they had no weapons and they were shot in the back. Yeah, so this was obviously a terrible, terrible scandal at the time. But the most important change is that before Bloody Sunday, there was a big argument between the IRA, people who think the military struggle was the only way, and the people who thought that democratic struggle was okay. And after Bloody Sunday, there was no argument, because these people said, yes, we must organise demonstrations and petitions. And the people from the IRA said, you're stupid. Your children were shot in front of your house. What do you need? Yeah. And the easiest job in the world, just after Bloody Sunday, was recruitment officer for the IRA. It was the easiest job in the world. Everybody wanted to join the IRA because it was just not possible for them to see their children shot in front of the house. And all the newspapers say they deserved it, etc. So there was a complete break in the possibilities of political progress. And so that was obviously tremendously important and led to 20 years of military conflict in Northern Ireland, where people on every side did some scandalous things. But that certainly was the most important element there. Now, I need to get back to the trade unions, because what was happening is that very slowly the economic boom was coming to an end. Yeah, the economic boom was coming to an end. That is to say, it was becoming more difficult for companies to make profit. And when during the boom, companies were making profit very easily. And so if the government said, companies, you must pay more tax for the hospitals, well, the company said, well, we don't like paying tax, but, you know, the company is going very well, it's easy to make profits, we don't mind paying a bit more tax. But as the boom came to an end, it became more difficult for employers to make profit. Yeah. Then, one, they didn't want to pay tax, and two, they didn't want to give wage rises. And so the conflicts between unions and employers became much more ferocious. The 1970s, in fact, is the time when the time when the unions were at their most powerful. The very high point of union power, trade union power in Britain, is in the 1970s. And in particular, in 1972, the miners' strike of 1972. And here you have two pictures from an event in the miners' strike of 1972. So what happened in the miners' strike is that around the country there was two kinds of picketing. First of all, there's picketing in front of the mines. And secondly, there was picketing in front of delivery depots and so on. So what's picketing? It's a very simple idea. Picketing is when the mine is on strike. And so you have a group of strikers in front of the mine, yeah, 10, 20, 30, 50. And when a lorry arrives to deliver anything, oil or food or whatever, they say, oh, listen, we're on strike, so we would like you to go home. Yeah, you know, when you're on strike, we support you. So now we're on strike. Please support us. And normally 50% at the time, 50% of the drivers say, oh, okay, no, I'm a trade unionist. I'm not delivering if you're on strike. I'm going home. Yeah. And so this was a method of making it easier to win a strike. That's what picketing is. But at this time, first of all, remember that mines, coal was extremely important to the economy. There were still, half a million miners maybe. Probably half a million miners. It was very, very big. There was no oil. Britain had no oil at the time. And so at this time, also the trade unions were very strong. This particular event is in Birmingham, Saltley Gasworks Coke Depot. Now, Coke Depot is a factory where coal is transformed into other things which are useful. Coke, which is not exactly the same thing. This became the symbol of the strike. If the factory continued to work, it looked like the strike was going to lose. And so the miners wanted to stop this factory from working. And they wanted to stop it by bringing a lot of people. And the government was discussing, shall we send the army? Shall we send the army with guns or the army without guns? It was a very, very hot situation, yeah. And in fact, what happened is that the miners went into Birmingham and they requested all trade unionists in Birmingham to come to this factory to stop the factory working. But to say, everybody in the car factories, in the shops, all the trade unionists, everybody come with us tomorrow to stop the factory working. And at this time, the trade unions were so influential that this was possible, and it worked. 100,000 car workers came to the factory, and the police closed the factory because there were just too many people. Yeah. So this was really the highest point of trade union power in Britain, when it was possible for one group of workers to say to, we need 100,000 people tomorrow, and they came. This was the very highest. This is not the situation today. Absolutely not the situation today. Probably quite naturally, the elites, in the British elite, were terrified. Think, oh my God, it was almost like the end of the world. And so certainly after Saltley, 1972, the Conservative Party and other sections of the establishment thought, you know, our absolute priority is to reduce the power of the trade unions. And we will be seeing how that plays out in the next hour or so. So what else did Edward Heath do? Well, something very important is that he got Britain to join the European Economic Community, which was the predecessor of the European Union. Britain had tried once before in the 1960s, but General de Gaulle said no. Yes. But in the 1973, then it was possible for Britain to join the common market. That's what we called it at the time, the common market. Its official name was the European Economic Community. Now, of course, the relations with Europe have gone up and down ever since and are still problematic today. But let's say that it's certainly extremely rare in Britain for people to feel European. Of course, people don't say every day in France, je me sens européen, but it is possible to say it was in Britain that they would just sound so funny. It would just sound like a joke, you know. We sometimes say as a joke that Britain is part of Europe, but the British didn't know about it. And it's a little bit the truth that there is there. There are historical reasons for this, and that is that for quite a while, but certainly since the Second World War, France has been. The centre of France's economy is Europe, whereas Britain has always had a choice. The ex-colonies, or the United States, or Europe, always had three options. And so Europe could never be economically as important as it is for France or Germany. And of course, when something is economically not important, it also becomes politically less important. So perhaps you know that in a couple of years' time, there is likely to be a referendum in Britain about leaving the European Union. Yeah? So whereas in France, we would be very surprised if the government said, oh, we're going to have a referendum about leaving the European Union. So it was Edward Heath who got the United Kingdom to join the European Economic Community at the beginning of 1973. Although, like I say, relations have been up and down since, and most notably, of course, Britain has not decided to join the euro. Interesting point, actually, because, you know, normally you would imagine that there would be many advantages. You know the problem, you know, like in Japan or Korea, when they're dealing with Europe and with Britain. And they can do one calculation for the money in all of Europe and a different calculation for Britain. It's a big disadvantage, but nevertheless, this has not been done. In 1974, the Conservatives lost the election and Labour came back in. Harold Wilson was again Prime Minister for only 2 years. And then we moved on to this old gentleman, James Callaghan. And perhaps you've noticed they were all old gentlemen, the last few ones, and that's going to change quite soon. James Callaghan, the Labour Prime Minister, 1976 to 1979, after Wilson's second term from 1974 to 1976. And again, I've only chosen four events, because, of course, you know, 12 things happen every year, but I can't give you too many. So here's four examples. 1975, the arrival of North Sea oil. North Sea oil, then oil found in the sea near Scotland, was, I think it was discovered in 1970. But it came online in 1975. And of course, from an economic point of view, this was extremely good news for British companies and for the British government. Because there was a lot of oil. Even today, there's still a lot of oil in the North Sea. So this is a big money. 1976, the IMF crisis. This was a crisis where Britain was obliged to go to the IMF, or as you say in French, because you say everything backwards in French, the FME. And again, this is the sort of debt crisis, not as bad as in Greece today, but nevertheless a serious debt crisis. 1976, the Race Relations Act, which I'm not going to say too much about because it's about multiculturalism and diversity, and I want to stay away from that today and just give you the general background. And in 1978, the Winter of Discontent, which was a series of public sector strikes. Again, strikes are becoming the key element here. So now, by 1976, I think that people are beginning to realise that the boom really has finished. You have 30 years of boom, and then 2 or 3 years of crisis. You know, well, maybe it's nearly finished. Of course, today we know that it was not nearly finished, but, you know, people don't know in future. So now it's very clear that there's a tremendous problem, and unemployment has risen much quicker. I think it was under Heath in 1973 that unemployment reached 1 million. And I remember this. It was a big shock. Of course, today, 2-3 million is not a shock anymore. But the first time it went back to 1 million was a tremendous shock. This doesn't mean it was the same as in the 1930s, because in general, in the 1930s, if you were unemployed, you received no money from the government, or very, very little. And of course, in the 1970s and today, unemployed people don't receive a lot of money, but they don't normally go hungry. So there's a difference in what is possible. So there he is, James Callaghan. I never know how to pronounce it, James Callaghan, James Callaghan. I think it's Callaghan. His father worked in the Navy. He was 64 years old, and he won the Labour leadership at this point, and then became Prime Minister. He was not the favourite to win the leadership, but he had another advantage, that he was the least divisive candidate. This is something that has happened a couple of times in the major parties in Britain, in Labour or Conservative, that when you're having an election for the leader, then you have, you know, the right-wing candidate and the left-wing candidate, and then you have somebody who is not really very popular, but nobody hates him. And you can win in that way, and this appears to be what happened to Callaghan. So, because of the IMF crisis, the Labour government began to establish cuts in social budgets. Now, cuts in social budgets will from now on be a major theme of all the governments, and it's still the big controversy today. Well, cuts in social budgets are difficult to do. Because one of the, from an economic point of view, one of the most expensive things about society today is that people live longer. And also, old people use hospitals more than young people. And so the general tendency over the last 50 years is for social budgets to rise. And the cuts have normally been really a matter of making the social budget rise more slowly. Because apart from, you know, shooting all the old people, which I'm not recommending, it's extremely difficult to actually cut. But nevertheless, they're real cuts. You know, people, if your hospital can be closed, and so there were a lot of cuts going on. This is symbolised by 1977. 1977 was the Silver Jubilee. That is to say, the Queen had been Queen for 25 years. That's a silver jubilee. Now, rather surprisingly enough, this was met with massive partying around the country. And here is quite a typical street in quite a typical town, where they put tables out on the streets to have a party because the Queen has been Queen for 25 years. Now, as you know, historians are not paid to consider people stupid, so there must be a reason why they wanted to do this. And especially in Britain, you know that the Britons are not like Greeks or Spanish people. We don't eat with people outside, you know, if we can help. You know, when you close the doors and light a fire, you know, and it's not, you know, I mean, it's not a tradition to be out on the streets all the time. So there is something quite impressive about this. And as you can see, well, you can see from the houses behind it, this is not the rich part of town. This is not the rich part of town, this is the perfectly ordinary part of town. And there's the Silver Jubilee, large numbers of street parties. And yet, at the same time, and the same year, you have the release of a very interesting song, God Save the Queen, by the Sex Pistols, who led the punk revolution in Britain. Which, of course, is a musical revolution, not a social revolution. God Save the Queen, very, very interesting song, which, first of all, it introduces sarcasm into rock music. I think there are no sarcastic rock songs before the Sex Pistols. They may be ironic, that's not the same, but this really is sarcastic. Remember the words, yeah? God Save the Queen, we mean it, man, we love our Queen. God save. Yeah. So it's a very, very, very powerful thing. It sold millions of copies. And so you have both opinions at the same time, yes, the Street Parties and the Sex Pistols. And at the bottom left, you have something which is actually a political badge. And it says, stuff the Jubilee, fight the cuts. So it's saying, you know, don't be interested in the Queen's Jubilee. The most important thing to do is to stop the closing of hospitals or the reduction of school budgets, etc. So this is the political conflict which is going on at the time. The end of Callaghan's time in office is marked by the winter of discontent. Very widespread public sector strikes. Very significant because if you want to organise strikes in the public sector, it's rather more difficult when there's a Labour government, because a lot of the trade union leaders will say, "Oh well, you know, let's not strike against a Labour government because it'd be worse if we had a Conservative government." Yeah. And so public sector strikes in particular, because remember the government is the employer of the public sector people, they are much harder to organise under a Labour government. And nevertheless, people were obviously very unhappy, because in 1978 there was quite a significant amount of strikes for money. The 1970s is still a period when inflation is quite high, sometimes 10% a year. And that is to say, every year the prices go up 10%, which is obviously a lot of money. And so there were these strikes. And because of this, the Callaghan government, lost a vote of confidence in March 1979 by just one vote, therefore were obliged to call a general election. This would not happen in the same way today. The constitution has been changed, and now, except in very exceptional circumstances, general elections are every 5 years. But in the past, they were whenever they were a maximum of 5 years, but any time the government wanted them. So this was a different situation. And the result was then the arrival of Margaret Thatcher and her own particular brand of conservatism, Thatcherism. And there you see a biography of her, and which shows some of the characteristics which are famous for Margaret Thatcher.